Good morning, everybody. We're going to get started if you're all out in the lobby there. This morning, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. James Galvin, who is a professor of integrated medical sciences and associate dean for clinical research at the Charles E. Schmidt College of Medicine. Dr. Schmidt got his medical degree in New Jersey and has been involved in research related to memory disorders, and today he's going to give us a talk on advances in Alzheimer's disease. It's my pleasure.
Well, good morning, everybody. So I thought what I would do is kind of give an update of kind of the programs that we're building here at FAU. There's no flat place to put this. So the general framework we're going to follow is some of the programs we're doing to improve diagnosis, to develop treatments, to maybe develop some prevention initiatives, and ultimately the goal is always to try to cure disease. As all the physicians know, curing a disease is quite difficult, so we may have much more success on this side necessarily than this side. This is my obligate disclosures. A lot of the things I'm going to show you are supported from my grants from NIH and the department, Florida Department of Health, as well as a number of other foundations. I am an active clinical trialist. I'm going to talk a little bit about clinical trial data. I'd have some consulting and royalty arrangements, but I own no stocks or equities. And, of course, these are all the people that actually do all the work. So I write grants, and they do a lot of the work, so I'm going to acknowledge them up front. So before we talk a little bit about Alzheimer's disease, I think it's just relevant to kind of have a frame of reference. And so we're going to focus mostly on people with dementia and the programs for dementia here in the talk, but you should have some reference point that what is healthy aging. In terms of healthy brain aging, it's really the absence of cognitive decline. And this can occur well into the 10th decade of life. So people who have healthy brains can still carry out their activities of daily living, lead a productive and happy life. Now, they may have physical limitations that prevent them from doing things like they used to do, but from a cognitive perspective, if we could remove those physical limitations, they'd still be able to do them. So with age, though, it usually takes us a lot longer to do things. So we do think slower as we age. So it takes us longer to finish a project. It takes us longer to recall information, but it usually comes back after a short delay, and the information that comes back is correct. So one thing I want you to take away from today briefly is that memory loss is not part of the aging process. There is no age-associated cognitive impairment. Most of that is just because it takes longer for people to do things. When you correct for time, then there are no deficits in memory as people get older. And in fact, people can continue to increase their vocabulary and their fund of knowledge up until the time they pass. So memory loss is not part of the aging process. If you see someone who having memory problems, there's something causing it. It's up to you to figure out what that something is. One of the somethings it could be is dementia. And so dementia is really a general term. It's not a diagnosis. You shouldn't diagnose people with dementia. It's a syndrome. What it means is a change in memory or other thinking functions that interferes with everyday activity and cannot be directly attributed to another disease. Okay? So, for example, if someone had herpes encephalitis and they weren't thinking very well, they don't have a dementia, they have herpes encephalitis. And if you treat the herpes encephalitis, their memory should improve unless there's significant damage done by the encephalitis. But it's not really a diagnosis. I know as a neurologist who sees patients, I get a lot of people and they'll come in and say, the doctor said I have dementia, but I don't have Alzheimer's disease. And that's really doing a disservice to the patient because they don't really ever have an actual diagnosis. And if you don't have a diagnosis, it's really hard to have an action plan for their problem. So there are really over 100 different causes of dementia. And if you want more practical example, think of the word dementia as the same as the word car. So car is a four-wheeled vehicle that gets people around from point A to point B, but there are lots of different types of cars, and all those different cars are different. So when you say, I have a car, you really don't say, hey, I bought a car. You say, I bought a whatever type you drive. So just keep that in mind. So then what is Alzheimer's disease? Well, Alzheimer's disease is the most common cause of dementia. Okay. It affects over 5 million Americans, and most of those people are over age 65, but about 250,000 are under the age of 65. We term this early onset. So early onset and late onset disease are essentially the same disease, or there may be some difference in symptom presentation. So it's just a magical number at 65 we use as a cutoff. And the prevalence increases with age. So the population at age 65 is about 2% with Alzheimer's disease. And by age 85, you're at 42%. So really about 40 to 50% of all of the older adults that you're seeing in any situation are likely to have some cognitive impairment. Now, if you have a diabetic, you're trying to manage their blood sugars, and they have dementia, how well do you think they're going to manage their blood sugars? Not very well. And if you haven't really gone ahead and looked at their cognition, and you're trying to self-educate them to measure their insulin based on their finger sticks, you're going to have a lot of problems. So it really does affect the multiple diseases on top of just the brain aspects of it. The annual treatment costs exceed $200 billion. This makes it the third most expensive disease in the United States when you're caring for people. So cardiovascular disease and all of the cancers grouped together are one and two. And then Alzheimer's disease is number three because people become very dependent, so they have to utilize a lot of services. And then there's lots of indirect cost of the disease because their caregivers then are responsible for covering a lot of the task. It's the sixth leading cause of death in the United States in older adults. Okay, so people can die directly of Alzheimer's disease. When you're in severe enough stage, your brain stops working and eventually you'll die. More commonly is people die of situations they get into because of their Alzheimer's disease. So they're more prone to infections, to falls, to decubitus ulcers, et cetera. And the Alzheimer's is the most common diagnosis in the long-term care facilities. About 50% of all beds are occupied by people with Alzheimer's disease, so by far the most common cause. And that's where a lot of the cost comes into the play in the disease because the median cost for nursing home care, you know, is somewhere in the order of $70,000 to $90,000 a year per person. So if you start thinking about this and add up the numbers, you can see how we get to $200 billion pretty quick. And the real challenge, and I was talking in the lobby, is that, you know, you consider this sort of an epidemic in some ways. It's not infectious. It doesn't pass from person to person. But what is happening is the population is aging. And that's really two reasons. So one is that the biggest part of the population pyramid are the baby boomers, 1946 to 1964. So those were the children that came out of basically the era before them. So the Great Depression and World War II, it started being more prosperous, and so people had lots and lots and lots and lots of children. So it's by far the biggest segment of the population pyramid, and all of those individuals now approaching the age of risk. Okay, so I was born in 1964. That's the last year of the baby boomers, right? The other issue is we've gotten really good at treating lots of other diseases. So on top of the fact that we improve, you know, water and air, at least under the current administration, who knows what will happen next. There's also, we get really effective at treating diabetes and hypertension and heart disease, so people are living through those things which would take them out of the risk pool, and now they're living longer, and age is the greatest risk factor for the disease. So in 2009, we estimated 5.2 million, and by 2050, we're talking about 16 million just in the United States and maybe 60 to 70 million people worldwide, with actually the largest proportion of cases coming in underdeveloped countries because they're now also seeing some public health improvements, so their populations are aging. So this is going to be a worldwide issue. Just really briefly, if anybody is unfortunate enough to have to reboard constantly like I do every 10 years, so this is the type of pathology on a medicine board you might see. So this is a gross section of the brain. And so one has Alzheimer's and one doesn't, and you can clearly tell the difference. The Alzheimer's is the smaller brain. So there's a dilation of the ventricle, there's smaller volume, and particularly the hippocampus is markedly shrunken. The hippocampus is the seat of short-term memory. And then under the microscope, what you'll see under H&E stains is a senile plaque. It looks like a little punched-out lesion. Under fluoroscopy, you can see the tangles because they fluoresce. And then immunohistochemistry, you can see the diffuse and compact plaques. And also you can see the vascular pathology. And then this is what it looks like under a silver stain. The reason just to mention this briefly is that while clinically we make diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, pathologically, actually the most common cause of disease is a mixed dementia, so multiple pathologies, although those pathologies may be silent clinically, you won't necessarily see them, but when people come to autopsy, by far the more common disease is Alzheimer's plus something else, so most commonly vascular disease. So what we've done at FAU since I've been there is try to build up a program that allow us to do some really neat things and be fairly cutting edge as we do it. So we have this comprehensive center for brain health and really focusing on not only Alzheimer's disease but other brain diseases and really looking at brain health. So trying to shift the conversation from talking solely about the disease and more how we can actually try to do things to prevent or mitigate our risk for disease. So just to put this in perspective, so this is the demographics from South Florida. So this is from Medicare beneficiaries, and so the first column is national data, then Florida data, and then specifically Palm and Broward counties. And so if you look at the percentage of Alzheimer's disease nationally, it's about 9.8% of all beneficiaries have Alzheimer's disease. In Florida, it's 11%, and then in Palm Beach and Broward County, it's even a little bit above that. And so, you know, this is a rampant problem. So in your practice, you're going to see a lot of cases of Alzheimer's disease, whether you recognize it or not. Okay. There's also a host of other issues. And all of these issues are important because Alzheimer's disease acts as a cost multiplier. So Alzheimer's disease is going to worsen the outcomes for all of these chronic illnesses as well. So let's now focus on our concept, and let's talk a little bit first about some of our efforts to improve diagnosis. So there are many ways to try to assess people for Alzheimer's disease, and the most common way is you give them some performance test, mini mental state exam, for example. The challenge with that is that if you've not done one before on the person, the score is uninterpretable, right? Because you're giving them a test and they give a score, and then you have no frame of reference as to what that score means. So if they score 25 on the mini mental state exam, all you know is they scored 25. You don't know if they would have scored 25 a year ago. You don't know that if they would have scored 25 10 years ago. You don't know if that represents a change from some previous level of abilities. And you have no idea how much that interferes with their everyday activities. So based solely on performance, it's almost impossible to make a diagnosis. So what we'd like to do is then to try to combine methods and try to get some sense of change. So this is a test that we developed called the AD8. It's an 8-item yes-no questionnaire. So it takes about 2 minutes to complete. It could be done in person, over the phone, or over the web. What we generally recommend in practice is you basically, you know, put this on a clipboard, and when they sign in, you know, you have the person or the person who's accompanying the patient fill it out. It can be done by either the patient or an informant. It just asks 8 questions, and we're trying to capture, is there a change? So problems with judgment, reduced interest in hobbies, repeats themselves, trouble using appliances, trouble with month or year. We don't ask day or date because many people are retired, don't necessarily keep track of the dates. Difficulty handling financial affairs, trouble with appointments, and are these problems occurring daily? So what we're able to do is look at, is there cognitive change in comparison to what they used to do, and does that seem to interfere with their usual activities? And so if you have consistent change reported, even when their brief test may be in the quote-unquote normal range, this may represent a significant cognitive change. And because each person is their own control, you're comparing that person to themselves, right? Then it's less biased by how much education they did or their culture, primary language, whatever the case may be. But it is dependent on having someone being a reliable, observant informant, right? So either the patient has to have enough insight to answer the questions, and many patients actually can do this, or, you know, the spouse, for example, or the adult child who can give you some comparator information. So you're a little limited by that. So what we find is that, so the CDR is the Clinical Dementia Rating Scale. So this is a gold standard rating scale for cognition used in research and clinical trials. A CDR 0 is not demented, and a CDR 0.5 is the very earliest staging of dementia. And what we found is either the informant or the patient, if there's no problem, they rate in below 2, And if there is a problem, they're rated above 2. So 2 is the cutoff, and it has a very large effect size. So effect size gives you the clinical estimate of how likely you are to recognize the case in front of you. And so very, very large effect size. The other thing that's nice is that if the ADH score is greater than 2, then the people are more likely to carry the APOE4 allele, which is the major genetic risk factor for Alzheimer's disease, and they will have abnormal biomarkers in imaging or in their cerebral spinal fluid. So they have low amyloid and high tau proteins in their CSF, and they have amyloid binding on PET imaging. So this little 8-item yes-no questionnaire does a really good job of capturing people who likely have Alzheimer's disease. They also have smaller hippocampal volumes on their MRI. So we've been able to take this now and pretty much generalize it across the world. We've done studies in multiple countries in the native tongue. It works just as well in Indonesia as it does in Ecuador. So you're really able to overcome a lot of the racial and cultural and language biases that occur in cognitive testing. So in a clinical sample, the area under the curve is 92%, which means more than 9 times out of 10, we're going to correctly classify someone's gold standard evaluation with this little 8-item yes-no questionnaire. And it really works for all of the dementias, although it probably works best for Alzheimer's disease. It really works very well for all of the dementias because it's really trying to capture that essence of change. So then I remember I said, you know, if you just did a performance test, then you're going to get a score, which is good. It's great to have performance, don't get me wrong. But if you can combine both a self-report with a performance measure, you should be able to increase your power then because that performance now will be linked to change. And in fact, when you combine the AD8 with a performance test like a word list recall, for Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, we're classifying about 97% of cases, and for mild cognitive impairment, about 91% of cases. So very powerful way of increasing the diagnosis without taking a lot of clinical time. I know you can't read this. That's okay. I'm going to show some blow-ups. One of the challenges we had when we tried to use the AD8 in a lot of clinical studies is that because it's simply yes and no, we can only get a sense, is there a problem or not? But we really couldn't grade the problem. We couldn't stage it. And we couldn't do a differential diagnosis based on yes-no questionnaires. So we went and then developed a follow-up study, which is called the Quick Dementia Rating System, or the QDRS. And so now this has 10 questions, and now the questions have multiple choice answers. And so this allows us then to get a sense within each domain how much change there is, so we can start to stage people. So, for example, for the memory question, it's not just do they have a problem or not, but now qualitatively how significant that problem is. So from no obvious memory problems to consistent mild problems to mild to moderate loss, moderate to severe loss, or severe loss. And so this, again, is either rated by an informant or by the patient. Informants are better raters than patients are, but patients can still actually do a pretty good job of rating themselves. And then you basically add up the scores. So we have this for mood. We have it for attention and concentration. So now 10 domains. So we're getting much finer detail about what's going on. And the essence here is that, you know, when you compare controls to people with mild cognitive impairment or any other dementia, the scores dramatically increase. So for controls, their scores are usually less than 1. And for the MCI and above, their scores are higher. And the scores get progressively higher as you go through the stages of dementia. The other nice thing is because now there's 10 questions, you can actually start to use the questions to develop differential diagnoses. Because the first symptoms that change in Alzheimer's disease are going to be different than the symptoms that first appear in vascular dementia. Okay, so we have nice cutoffs. So normals are 0 or 1. Mild cognitive impairment is 2 to 5. Mild dementia is 6 to 12. Moderate, 13 to 20. And severe, 20 to 30. So we get a nice range of scores. We've gone on to try to develop some other diagnostic tools to improve our ability to pick up dementias. So we developed this tool for Lewy body dementia. So Lewy body dementia is the second most common cause of dementia after Alzheimer's disease. And again, now we just have a 10-item checklist, and it's a probability score based on autopsy-confirmed cases. So if you have more than 3 of these boxes checked, the statistical probability that dementia is caused by Lewy bodies rather than a disease like Alzheimer's disease. So it enabled us to build our probability models. We've also developed some cognitive tests to try to capture on some of the more update things we know about neuropsychology. A lot of the batteries that are used by neuropsychologists are based on the Wechsler intelligence scales and the Wechsler memory scales. They were developed in the 1950s. And so although the tests have been updated, the principles by which they were developed are, you know, half a century old. So we've been trying to tap into some of the more newer information. And so this test is very challenging for everybody, but it's particularly challenging if you have a cognitive impairment. So you get a key, you have numbers, and you have symbols. And you get to practice. You have to convert the numbers into the symbols and the symbols into the numbers. So once you can demonstrate you can do the practice, then we say go. And you have 90 seconds to try to do as many as you can. And so we start off going one way, but then the task becomes difficult because they have to start switching back and forth between number to symbol or symbol to number. And that's really hard for people with cognitive impairment to do. If you don't have cognitive impairment, once you're doing the task, and you may realize this from sitting in the audience, there's a couple of patterns that repeat themselves. And so if you're not cognitively impaired, you can actually do it even faster, because once you learn that, you know, some symbols are overrepresented, then you'll be able to go faster, and it'll cut down the time. The other thing we want to do to improve diagnosis is try to understand some of the underlying biomarkers associated with the disease, right? So, you know, many of you have probably ordered an MRI, and MRI is a great clinical tool, but it's also a great research tool because we can look at volumetric changes that are occurring with the disease. And so we can develop early biomarkers based solely on the amount of volume loss that we see in MRI. So here's a healthy control. So these are four different individuals. This is not one individual followed longitudinally. It's just that these cuts are all at the same level, so you can kind of see some of the quantitative and qualitative differences. So this is the hippocampus right here, okay? And this is the third ventricle right here. So let's look and see what happens as we kind of go through people from no impairment to very mild cognitive impairment to mild dementia to moderate dementia. And what you see is that the space around the hippocampus starts to increase, so there's hippocampal volume loss, and the diameter or width of the third ventricle is starting to increase. And this represents the atrophy. So by the time we get to the moderate stage of dementia, I know you can probably appreciate the hippocampus is just a tiny little sliver there. Okay? This is a very, very sensitive biomarker. Okay? And what's really nice about it is that there's really very little age-associated atrophy that occurs in a brain. Most of the atrophy that occurs in healthy people is really due to white matter volume loss, so your corpus callosum and your white matter bands that connect the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, they get smaller as you get older. So most of your volume loss is really white matter, not gray matter. If you see gray matter loss, there's almost none of that actually happens associated with age. And any pathologist can tell you that. Take the brain out of a healthy 85-year-old, it weighs 1,500 grams. If you take the brain out of a healthy 25-year-old, it weighs 1,500 grams, right? There's not a lot of volume loss associated with age, right? Once you lose gray matter, that's disease. Which disease it is, that's up to you to figure out, but there's very little associated. So if you start seeing spaces like that, that's never appropriate for age, right? You would not want to have that hippocampus. You wouldn't be sitting here in the audience if you had that hippocampus, okay? Doesn't matter how old you are. The other thing we can do is we can use some of the newer PET technologies. So this is an amyloid PET, florbetapir. So this is an F18 compound. It binds to the amyloid plaque. And so a healthy control has no cortical signal. There's a little bit of white matter uptake, so it's a little sticky, so it sticks to the white matter, so you can see the outline of the white matter here, but there's nothing in the cortex, the gray matter mantle. And here you can see in a person who has mild disease, there's the beginning of some deposits. In the person who has more significant disease, you can see the red highlights here that it's robust depositing in the cortex. Right? So this is a very sensitive measure of amyloidosis in the brain, and so we're using this as an early biomarker for Alzheimer's disease, and as an inclusion criteria for enrollment into some of the newer Alzheimer's clinical trials. In other words, if you have an anti-amyloid therapy, you have to demonstrate that a person has amyloid before they get the therapy. And there's only two ways to do that. One is by PET scan, and the other is by spinal tap. Okay? That's the only way. You can't measure amyloid in the blood in any usable way. You can measure it, but it's not a reliable marker. The other thing is, if you start now taking what's going on in the brain, both gray and white matter, as well as what's going on in the amyloid, you can begin to develop some models here. And so we can start to use these different imaging modalities and statistically model out what's happening with that individual. So we can begin to understand what is the rate of progression that occurs between cortical atrophy, loss of white matter connectivity, and amyloid deposition. And so this is going to make it much easier for us going forward to then begin to develop individual predictor models. Okay, we're not there yet. This is still group-based analysis. But we're beginning to get enough data and model that we can use some advanced statistical approaches to develop individual risk profiles. So when your patient comes in and you've did two of these tests, we're close to developing algorithms that can tell you on an individual basis how likely that person is going to develop Alzheimer's disease in the next 5 years. The other thing we can do is fMRI, so functional MRI. Functional MRI is more or less a research tool at this point. There are a few clinical paradigms, but basically it's a research tool. The nice part is you can line up all the networks, so you can build like a heat map here. So on the diagonal is where the networks are all interrelated. And so each part of the brain has its own network, and each network has a specific function. And we can look at the generation of networks as part of disease. So here, we're looking at something called the singular opercular network. Okay, this is your error-checking network. So before you do something from a motor perspective, you error-check. Okay, in other words, when I'm going to walk, am I taking a step in the right way? You don't consciously think about this, but your brain does a quick error check, and that's the singular opercular network. So it overlays both the basal ganglia and the motor cortex. Okay. So this is the network in a healthy control, and this is the network in a person with Parkinson's disease. Hopefully from the back you can appreciate that the color actually becomes a little redder here. So because Parkinson's patients, it's harder for them to walk. Initially, the brain is working a lot harder in terms of error-checking their gait. This is a person who's normal. This is a person who has Alzheimer's disease. And you can see that this network is almost impossible to detect. It's degenerating. Okay, Alzheimer patients fall quite a bit. And this is a person with Parkinson's dementia. So this initial overcompensation is then lost as they develop dementia. And then while the network is still recognizable, it's much less organized. So what's happening to the brain in Alzheimer's disease is different than what's happening to the brain in Parkinson's disease. All right? And so we can begin to use these networks to help us not only develop prevention measures, like fall prevention type of studies, but we're able to understand the underlying biologies of the diseases. Another biomarker we've used is EEG. Many of you have seen clinical EEGs. This is a research EEG. It's 256 channels. So this is a very dedicated volunteer. If any of the residents or students have rounded on someone who's hooked up to an EEG, you won't see this many leads. It takes well over an hour to put on. It takes well over an hour to take off. And it takes like two bottles of shampoo to get all the glue out of your hair. Not for me. That's pretty quick for me to get it out. The idea is we get full coverage of the brain, so we get very, very intense data here. So we're able to look at spectral analyses. Here's spectral analyses of four different types of cases. These are healthy controls, people with mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's disease, people with non-demented Parkinson's disease, and people with mild cognitive impairment due to Parkinson's disease. So four different disease states. And you can see, if you know nothing else about EEG spectra, they're not the same pattern. So as we're seeing these breakdowns in networks, we're also seeing differences in actual electrophysiological brain activity. So as you go into dementia stages, you have less fast wave and you have more slow wave activity. Okay, so there's a change in the electrophysiological pattern. And we can begin to use this as a diagnostic signal as well. So we could take all this together then. We begin to actually build models to understand the disease. And why are you saying, well, we already know a lot about Alzheimer's disease, why are you building a model? Because the key is not to figure out who has Alzheimer's disease. The key is to figure out who's going to get Alzheimer's disease. OK? okay? So you have to do these things across longitudinal studies to try to understand where the transition occurs. So in this study, we took Alzheimer cases and controls, and we had an autopsy-verified sample so that we could confirm that we were going in the right direction. On the bottom are the years, so time from diagnosis, and on the y-axis is their performance on neuropsychological testing, okay? And this dotted line is when we made the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, okay? So we were following people when they were normal, and then a bunch of them developed Alzheimer's disease. And so the people who stayed healthy controls, you can see there's less than a standard deviation of change over time. So there's very little memory loss that's associated with time, right? So this is, you know, 10 years of data. So older adult over 10 years, there's very little change in their cognitive abilities. And I can make this become almost a flat line by adjusting for speed. For the people who have Alzheimer's disease, if you go back in time, about 2 to 3 years before, you can see there's a change in the slope of their cognitive performance. So they have an inflection point, okay? Which means that we now have this 2 to 3 year window of preclinical disease. They have Alzheimer's disease in their brain. They don't have clinical Alzheimer's disease yet, right? So if you had a medicine that could modify disease, where would you want to give that medicine? Would you want to give it out here? Or would you want to give it up here? Right? So this would be the target. Right? So you have to identify the target to know where you're going to go. And so the beauty of all this data I've been showing you is we can really develop some great models. So we can look at Alzheimer's disease, we look at Parkinson's disease, we can look at Lewy body disease, and then we could develop evolution patterns, right? So that we know roughly where in the pathway different domains are changing. And that lets us develop diagnostic tests that are more specific. So, for example, in Parkinson's disease, this is about where the diagnosis is occurring. And so a test of episodic memory, that's like a list learning test, you know, remember this list of words, doesn't change in Parkinson's disease until they're already demented. So now if your primary screening test is a list of words and you have a Parkinson patient with you, you're very unlikely to actually pick up their dementia until they're already demented. It's the wrong test. Okay? So you have to use different types of tests and different types of dementias to pick up this early lag phase, this early preclinical phase. So how do you apply all this going forward? Well, now you can take all this strategy and now you could do public health initiatives. So this is a project I did in Missouri. It's called Project Learn More. And so what we did was I partnered with the Area Agency on Aging, all 10 offices in Missouri, and the 4 chapters of the Alzheimer's Association. And what I basically did was I trained all of the field workers in the Area Agency on Aging to do dementia screening. So they do home visits. That's what they do. Okay, they're mostly high school educated field workers, some college, some associate degrees. So I trained them to do dementia screening. So in the context of their in-home assessment, they screened for dementia. So over a year, we screened about 4,000 people. Our incident cases were 28%. So it's new cases detected during screening was, you know, nearly a third of the older adults they were going to visit, okay? We made a whole bunch of referrals, and some people didn't want to be referred for whatever reason. But for the people that referred, we sent them to the Alzheimer's Association where they got a detailed care consultation with a social worker. In other words, they basically got entered into the medical system with a social worker giving, okay, here's what you need, here's your stage, here's what you need, here's the services you need, let's get you to a doctor who can diagnose you, let's get a doctor who's going to prescribe medicines for you, let's get a doctor that's going to manage your hypertension and all these other things, right? But the only intervention we did was actually just a social work consultation. And what we found was a threefold delay in nursing home placement. Okay, simply by getting people diagnosed really early and getting the services that they need. Okay, this is not a medicine. It's a very powerful intervention just by getting people diagnosed early and getting them services that they need. And no one's going to say that the Alzheimer medicines are that powerful of an individual medicine, right? They work, but they have a modest effect. But it's the early introduction of the medicines and all of the other aspects of managing the disease that makes the hugest difference. So just by, you know, developing these screening tests and these models, we can actually see public health changes. we have a grant out that's with a foundation now, and the goal here is that, well, how could we do this down here in Florida? And so we're trying to develop basically a mobile consultation service where we go out and do geriatric-based assessments, identify early problems, and then get those people entered into the healthcare system. Okay? Now, you think about Palm Beach County, all along the coast, it's fairly wealthy, right? But if you go inland from the county, it's not. Okay? And so there's a tremendous lack of medical services as you head inland in Florida. Okay? The idea is, can we go out there and bundle services, so not just a medical evaluation, but a social evaluation, and to give each person a case manager to make sure they actually get the services that they need. Okay? So just an idea of how we can change the approach. All right, let's focus on what we're doing on treatment. So there are medicines currently available, and they have modest effects, but they do have real effects. They are modest, though. So this is an interesting data. This is from Harvard, and this is not from clinical trials. This is not an industry-sponsored study, right? So there are about 10 centers around the country that have very long-standing longitudinal studies. These longitudinal studies extend prior to the treatment era of Alzheimer's disease, okay? And all of the centers that have these longer studies have done very similar studies, and all have found essentially the same results. Okay, so I'll show you the one from Harvard, but the one from Hopkins, the one from Pittsburgh, the one from Cache County, Utah data, actually some of the Framingham data now, are all showing the same basic patterns. Okay, so if you look at people who get no treatment, people who get monotherapy, and people who get combination therapy, okay, and you look what happens either in terms of their cognition or in terms of their activities of daily living, their function. What you see is that there's a progressive change in the people who get no treatment. While there is change in people who have monotherapy, they are different, statistically different, than the people who get no therapy, but the effect difference is very small, right? The effect size, that is, can you look at a person who's treated and determine whether they're being treated or not for their disease, okay? But the combination is actually a very large effect size. And the longer you treat, the bigger the effect size. So at 1 year, this 1 year time point, the difference between all the groups is relatively small. But the longer you treat, the slower the progression of symptoms in those individuals who get combination therapy. So the effect size from combination versus no treatment is about 50% at 1 year and 77% at 4 years. Okay? And the effect is even bigger in many ways for the function. So that monotherapy for function really is not much different than no therapy at all in terms of their activities of daily living, but combination therapy has a very large effect, okay? And the longer you treat, the bigger that effect becomes, okay? So the advantage of a study like this, one, it's a natural study, and so two is that clinical trials, just by definition, are generally about 6 months long. And so you only have data for 6 months. And it's very hard to project clinical trial data longer. There are mathematical formulas. You can do it, but you're using estimated data. This is real data. This is actually showing what's happening over a long period of time. So this is one of the newer studies that's going on, aducanumab, which is monoclonal antibody against amyloid. Okay, anything that ends in AB is an antibody. And if it's mAb, then it's a monoclonal antibody. If it has some other letter in front of it, then it's not a monoclonal antibody. It's some other variation of an antibody. Okay. So aducanumab, or ADI for short, is a product that is made by Biogen. And so this is one of the real exciting ones for a couple of reasons. And one of the reasons is it's the only one that in its early phases not only met its safety profile, but actually had a clinical signal. Okay, so phase one and phase two studies are not powered to show a clinical effect. We collect the clinical measures, but the study is underpowered to show a difference between groups, right? The main goal of a phase one and a phase two is safety, right? Phase three studies are efficacy studies, okay? This is aducanumab's phase two study, and by week 54, there's a dramatic difference in the performance between the individuals. So this is in terms of their amyloid PETs. So this is the placebo. They still have the same amyloid PET that they did at baseline, whereas this is the highest dose group, and there's dramatic reduction in their amyloid in their brain. And there's a statistical difference in both their CDR and in their mini mental state exam. Okay, so both a global rating system and in a performance test, they're statistically different. So this is the first study in its early phases that showed when you remove amyloid, you actually can get a benefit. Okay, people are not getting better, they're just not getting worse. Right? You're modifying disease. You're not reversing disease here. Okay? And that's really quite a powerful observation. The key also is that you need to treat very early in the system, right? So once people are at the moderate stage of disease, they don't benefit from antibody therapies. There's no benefit at all, okay? Because there's too much damage and there's too many neurons lost to really get an effect. So you're going to have to target people at the prodromal, preclinical, mild cognitive impairment phase. And that's where some of the modeling we've been doing are really good because we're developing mechanisms to identify those individuals at that stage. Okay. Some other studies we're doing are in other dementias. This is, how am I doing in time? Okay. This is RVT-101, which is a treatment for dementia with Lewy bodies. And so this is an adjunct therapy. There are no medicines specifically approved for Lewy body dementia. So we're testing the first one that's specifically designed for that. And it could be done in combination with a standard cholinesterase inhibitor. And so it works on the serotonin system, and we're doing this for both REM sleep disorder as well as for Lewy body dementia. Okay. The other type of intervention we're doing is sort of an interprofessional education intervention. So we've done a lot of different platforms looking at outpatient and inpatient pre- and post-diagnosis for the patient and for the provider. And so these are complementary initiatives. So whatever type of information we're giving to the provider, we're giving that same information to the patients and their families so that when the two meet, they actually can speak common languages, right? So if I give the patient and the family a whole bunch of information and the physicians know nothing about that information, they can't really act on that information. So we try to develop complementary approaches. And we can have some really powerful effects. So let me show you an example of one. So this is a study we did and was published a couple of papers in JAGS and a couple of other places. And we just got funded by NIH to do this prospectively in a large multi-site system. So the concept here is that we want to develop this FAM care, family-centered, function-focused care. So when you admit a patient to the hospital, right after your admissions order, what's one of the first orders you write? Discharge planning, right? Because you want to get them out of the hospital, right? As quickly as possible, right? And who does the discharge planning? Who does your discharge planning? Case manager, okay? After the patient leaves the hospital, what happens to them? Who cares for them? The family. So our novel idea was why not include the family in the discharge planning team? So that the patient will have a better outcome because the family will be actually prepared to take the patient after discharge. It's kind of a novel idea, right? And so what we did was we focused on function, and we included the family. So it's jointly developed treatment goals and care plans. And what we showed for the patient 2 months after discharge, there's reduced delirium, there was improved ADLs and improved walking. From the family caregiver, they were better prepared to be a caregiver, and they had less anxiety. And when we looked at the hospital outcomes, there was a lower 30-day readmission rate, right? So the family is better capable of managing the patient. The patient is going to be less likely to come back and be readmitted. So again, you know, we can have very powerful interventions by thinking about how we could change the way we approach care. We can also develop sort of quality improvement markers, and then we can see, can we actually accomplish these things? So we can make an appropriate use of medical tests and evaluations so we can save money by doing appropriate tests and avoiding inappropriate tests. We can have appropriate pharmacotherapy for the dementia syndrome using stage-appropriate medications, and we avoid some of the bad side effects that occur with any appropriate use of medications. And we can have facilitated communication between all the clinicians, right? So we can set these goals, and then we can actually see, can we make a quality improvement measure? One of the newest things we did was develop this clinical translational research unit. We just opened it in July. It's almost 8,000 square feet of brand new research space. And the goal is we want to be able to test novel agents, first in human kind of studies. This is our lobby. We don't have a staff yet. It was soon to have a staff. We have a computer here now, so we're getting there. You know, here's our future donor wall, hopefully. We have this nice state-of-the-art facility. We can do all sorts of physical testing, anthropometric testing. We have an infusion bay. We have 3 infusion bays, so we can do antibody studies. So we're really able to do some really neat and novel things. What about cure? Well, we can spend a lot less time talking about cure because we don't have one. But we are working toward the idea that we could. And one of the things that's really cool at FAU is up at our Harbor Branch campus, we have a marine biomedical and biotechnology unit. And so oceans have lots of really neat things. And some of the things you take out of oceans have no homologs on land. But a lot of these things they dig out of the ocean actually have very powerful, potentially pharmaceutical-based properties. Harbor Branch has one of the largest libraries of ocean molecules, and they've been very successful now at looking at some things that look very promising as cancer chemotherapeutic agents. And at least one of the compounds they've dug out looks like it potentially could be a BACE inhibitor. So BACE is one of the enzymes that generates amyloid beta protein. And so one of their products looks like it might be. Now, you have to get it from something dug out of a sea anemone into a medicinal compound. So there's a lot of work to be done, but there's a lot of really neat things we can do. So I think this offers us a great opportunity to think about a cure initiative. So by working with our basic scientist, our clinical scientist, and our translational scientist, and then benefiting from the partnerships of FAU, Scripps Florida, and Max Planck, we can actually begin to have this really dynamic network where we can move promising ideas, you know, from the patient from the lab to the patient considerably faster because we have that medicinal chemistry capability. And the last couple minutes, I want to talk about some of the things that are really cool that we're just getting launched, and that's the idea of prevention, right? So it's much better to try to prevent a disease than to try to cure a disease, right? So if you think about this in terms of a model, if this is a person who's sitting in front of you with Alzheimer's disease, before they show up at your office, they had some change in their cognition. Before they had some noticeable change in their cognition, they had some degenerative process going on in their brain, so loss of synapses, loss of neurons, loss of connections, loss of white matter bands. and so for Alzheimer's disease, well, that could be caused by plaques and tangles. And so if you have this pathology, then you can have a risk factor for that pathology. Let's call that risk factor A. But we know from studies of the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease, they don't just have plaques or tangles. Most of them have some other pathology. Well, if they have a different pathology, then they may have a different risk factor. So let's call that risk factor B. Okay? So if you wanted to try to prevent or cure the disease, you could attack risk factor A, which a lot of people are doing. But maybe we could attack risk factor B. Okay? So I mentioned this before. So if you look at the incidence of Alzheimer's disease in Florida, that incidence is accompanied by a lot of other multiple chronic conditions, right? And the data shows that if you have heart disease or diabetes or COPD and you have Alzheimer's disease, you have worse health outcomes than if you have the disease by itself. So it acts as a cost multiplier, increasing the medical complications of the disease. So our thought was if we started addressing some of these conditions, could we alter the effect on Alzheimer's disease, right? So we have this grant that was sponsored by NIH where we go out into the community, we do assessments, and we've assessed nearly 500 people, and we've built the concept of healthy body, healthy mind together. So we do broad medical screening in addition to cognitive screening. We want to try to understand the relationships between medical conditions and brain health. And you say, well, how could you do that? It must be really difficult. Well, this is our entire lab. Fits in a Pullman. And we can hop in our car or hop in a cab, whatever the case may be. I moved here from New York, so you didn't drive in New York. You took a cab everywhere. And so we could actually do a lot of measurements very simply and have a very comprehensive assessment of individuals. One of the cool things we can do is also look at body composition. You know, so here's your brain, which we want to keep healthy. And here's where I think where a lot of the money lives is right here. So we can get an estimate of bone. We can't really do bone density from impedance, but you get an estimate of bone. But we can measure water, lean muscle, and fat. And within fat, we can measure overall body fat, but more importantly, we can measure visceral fat. And visceral fat is a metabolically active organ, okay? Releases a lot of pro-inflammatory cytokines, okay? So we have some really interesting data. So in the literature, there's a lot of things talking about the risk of diabetes and the risk of Alzheimer's disease. And if you require insulin therapy, you have a significantly increased risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. And you have both Alzheimer pathology and vascular pathology associated with diabetes. What we have found is if you have an elevated hemoglobin A1C, you have a much higher risk of cognitive impairment, nearly a five-fold increased risk of performing poorly on a cognitive test. And these are people who are not demented. Okay, this is a community sample. What about obesity? If you look at all of the studies, the overall meta-analysis suggests about a 1.5-fold increased risk if you're obese to developing Alzheimer's disease. What we found is if your BMI is high, you have a significantly increased risk, about a 2-fold increased risk of developing cognitive impairment, and that corresponds to your biomarkers. So this is brain metabolism, and the higher your BMI is, the lower your brain metabolism. So that increased body mass is actually having deleterious consequences in your brain. And if you remove the fat part out of BMI, so if you look at just the lean BMI, there is no effect. So it's not the size of your body, it's the amount of fat you have. Okay. Now, there are differences between body fat and visceral fat. So what we did was we looked at both physical performance and cognitive performance. And what we found was that your body fat corresponds nicely to your physical performance, but your visceral fat corresponds to your cognitive performance. So the more fat you have, the worse your physical performance, but the more visceral fat you have, the worse your cognitive performance. Okay? Because remember, visceral fat is a metabolically active organ. Okay? And in fact, if you look at body fat, there is no relationship between biomarkers like brain metabolism and your BMI, but there's a very strong relationship between brain metabolism and visceral fat. Okay? Now, if you don't have a little impedance scale in your office and you can't do that, you can do a proxy marker, and that's with a tape measure, and you measure abdomen and hip, and you look at the ratio. Okay? And the bigger the ratio, the worse you are, the more visceral fat you have. Okay? And so, again, we see that ratio drives cognitive performance but not physical performance, and corresponds to decreased brain metabolism. Okay? So a very strong marker that's easily captured. Okay? What about hypertension? Well, if you look at all of the studies with hypertension, it's mixed. It's all over the place. You know, there are studies that show a very strong relationship, there are studies that show no relationship, and there are studies that show an inverse relationship, right? And so we kept wondering why we couldn't really understand what was going on with that. And even our data was really hard to interpret. And so then what we did was decide to look and see what the effect of age is on this and our biomarkers. And so this is on brain metabolism. This is on hippocampal volume. And what we see is we used a bunch of different ages, but 65 actually gave us the best number. And what we saw was if you're younger, high blood pressure is bad for your brain. But if you're older, low blood pressure is bad for your brain because you think your vascular resistance changes as you age, and so you need to have a little bit higher systolic blood pressure in order to perfuse your brain effectively. And so what we found, that there's a significant window for studying this that's based on age and vascular resistance. And we can measure this looking at not only blood pressure but pulse pressure, which is the difference between your diagnostic pressure and your systolic pressure. So systolic minus diastolic is your pulse pressure. The higher your pulse pressure is, the more rigid your aortic tree is. Okay. We also looked at muscle mass. So there's sarcopenia, which is the age-related loss of muscle mass and strength. And so the more muscle you lose, the higher risk you are at having cognitive impairment. So somewhere between a 3- and 6-fold increased risk, depending on how much you adjust the model. Okay. So as you lose muscle, you're actually losing cognitive abilities as well. If you are losing function, that's a much better predictor of non-Alzheimer pathologies than Alzheimer pathologies, in particular vascular pathology. So if you're losing physical functioning, it's a very strong predictor that you have a significant amount of cerebrovascular disease, even if it's subclinical. What about lung volumes? So I'm a neurologist by training, so I had to go back and kind of relearn pulmonary function testing. And so we were very interested in FEV1, or forced expiratory volume in the first second, which is most of what you can blow out, right? There's still your vital capacity, but most of it comes out in the first second. And the ratio between FEV1 and FVC is how we diagnose COPD on pulmonary function test. So normally it's greater than 0.8. For COPD, it's less than 0.7, okay? And you have to standardize it by age, gender, and height, because the taller you are, the bigger your lungs are, okay? And what we found was that if your ratio is abnormal, you had an 8-fold increased risk of poor performance on cognitive test, that this corresponded with lower hippocampal volumes and decreased brain metabolism, okay? So your inability to move air sufficiently through your lungs actually worsened your cognitive performance. Another thing you can do is look at lung age, which is used a lot in the smoking literature. So basically, you can calculate the age of the lung and compare that to vascular. And so every time this changes by 0.5 units, you lose a point on your cognitive testing. Okay. So let's go back to the last part with this model. So we talked about this model. We said, well, you have amyloid plaques, and so a risk factor for that is your APOE genotype. Okay, we know that. But how about diabetes? We think that this acts through vascular disease. Hypertension works through vascular resistance. Obesity works probably through inflammation from these adipokines. Physical function probably works through trophic factors from the muscle. COPD probably works by chronic hypoxia. And bone loss, which I didn't show you, we think works through vitamin D. So we have this sort of multiple pathway, and I show them all as individuals, but you remember these are all interacting, right? Because this is a living system and lots of things are happening. So this allows us then to launch a prevention initiative, which we're just getting off. And the idea is we can use a personalized prevention approach. We can develop other programs like fall prevention. I'll skip that. So multiple medical conditions can increase our risk of neurodegeneration. So, but if there are multiple pathways to get to Alzheimer's disease, that means there are multiple pathways to treat or prevent Alzheimer's disease. And I think that they're going to be most effective if we kind of identify at-risk individuals, and we can do this based on their overall physical profile. You can use this then to develop some very novel interventions, and we're doing a lot of this across the street at FAU and in combination with a lot of our partners here at Boca Regional Hospital and the rest of our consortium. And just keep in mind that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Thank you for your attention. Anybody has questions, I can answer them. I know you got to get back and do work too, but yes. Okay, so the question was about amyloid PET. So it is approved by the FDA, so you can order it now clinically. It's not covered by any medical insurance company. So it costs between $4,000 and $5,000 out of pocket. There is a study sponsored by CMS. It's a clinical efficacy study. So it's called the IDEAS study. So we're going to be a site. And so what we would do is we can order PET scans for patients that we think have Alzheimer's disease, and there's 18,000 people that are going to be enrolled. CMS is paying for the PET scan, they're paying for the ligand, but not for the PET scan. The PET scan would be covered by Medicare. And the idea is, would the amyloid PET actually change clinical care? And so at the end of the study, we hope to generate that data. And then CMS agreed that if we can demonstrate that they would pay for it. If CMS pays for it, likely there would be other third-party payers that would follow. But if CMS isn't covering it, Medicare, then no other insurance is going to cover it. So the likelihood is pretty good after we finish the study, but we need all the data. We want 18,000 cases. So far there are 2,000 cases enrolled, so we still have quite a bit of time to do that. But we're going to be a site across the street. Yeah.
How easy is it clinically to differentiate someone who has Lewy body dementia with Parkinson's
Okay. So Lewy body dementia is an umbrella term. It describes two different diseases, dementia with Lewy bodies and Parkinson's disease dementia. They are the same exact disease with the exception of which symptom came first. So by definition, if they have Parkinson's disease for more than a year before any cognitive symptoms appear, then it's Parkinson's disease dementia. If it's any other pattern, it's dementia with Lewy bodies, but both of them are Lewy body dementias. So the terminology gets a little confusing, but it's very easy in that case because if they had Parkinson's disease for 3 years and then developed memory problems, it's Parkinson's disease dementia. If any other pattern occurs, it's dementia with Lewy bodies. So we typically start to use just Lewy body dementia just to cover both because it's an artificial timeline that was created just to make the movement disorder and the dementia kingdoms happy and not at war with each other. Yes? Right. So what role does alcohol have? So, you know, alcohol is a neurotoxin, but it's largely reversible in terms of its toxicity to brain. So if you look at people who are heavy drinkers, they typically have some atrophy, and if they actually abstain, after about 5 years, a lot of that atrophy may reverse. So it's really a shrinkage rather than a total loss of cells. So most people now think that what was called alcoholic dementias in the past were really two different things. One was either Alzheimer's disease, and they happen to be also alcoholics, or two is alcoholics do something else, they fall. They fall a lot and they hit their head a lot. And so the other thing might have been whether this was chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which has more behavioral symptoms or different types of behavioral symptoms than Alzheimer's disease. So probably what was used to be called alcoholic dementia was Alzheimer's and or CTE. But if someone has dementia and they drink, they're going to perform much worse because they have no reserve. They can't tolerate any insults or imbalances. So you'd want to try to get your people who have – so like a glass of wine a day is generally thought to be pretty good from heart health. But once they have a dementia, any alcohol will decrease their cognitive performance quite a bit. Yes? So there are two classes of medicines currently approved. So one is the cholinesterase inhibitors, donepezil, which used to be Aricept, rivastigmine, which used to be Exelon, and Razadine, or galantamine, which used to be Razadine. So that's one class. The other class are the NMDA receptor antagonist, or Namenda is the only member of that. So the combination approach that most of us use is to start someone on a cholinesterase inhibitor, get them up to the highest tolerated dose, and then start Namenda and get them to the highest tolerated dose. And so it's a combination therapy approach. There are some medical foods that are also approved. So these are still by prescription, but they're not pharmaceuticals. They're nutraceuticals that are under FDA regulation. And they have very, very modest effects. And so you really want to pick and choose when you want to use them because they're not routinely covered by insurance. For the most part, the stimulants are not tolerated by older adults. They cause lots of side effects. Some of the second-generation stimulants that are used for narcolepsy have been used for people who have severe attentional deficits, apathy, and fluctuations in their cognition. So Provigil or Nuvigil, which is modafinil or amodafinil, have been used, and they are better tolerated, but they tend to provoke severe anxiety in older adults with dementia. So you have to be really careful about picking and choosing which one you want to use and why. So the stimulants cause anxiety in everybody, but in dementia patients, it can be really intolerable anxiety. So then you're treating one symptom with a medicine that generates an entirely new symptom, requires another medication. It may not be worth it. But the older ones like Ritalin, should not be used in older adults. They're not tolerated. Well, thank you for your attention. Have a nice day.